On Saturday, a well-known snake-handling preacher from Kentucky died after he was bitten by a venomous serpent during a church service. He'd been featured in a National Geographic reality TV show last fall called Snake Salvation. And you may recall his story in an NPR feature about the religious tradition of handling snakes. NPR's John Burnett has this obituary.
Last October on this program, we introduced you to Pastor Jamie Coutts, a 42-year-old Pentecostal preacher and third-generation snake handler from Middlesboro, Kentucky.
We sing, we preach, we testify, take up offerings, pray for the sick, you know, everything like everybody else does. Just every once in a while, snakes are handled.
News arrived over the weekend that on Saturday night, Coutts was handling three rattlesnakes at his small church, the Full Gospel Tabernacle in Jesus' Name, when one of them bit him on his right hand. He lost consciousness and was taken home, where his family refused anti-venom treatment by an emergency medical crew. Jamie Coutts was pronounced dead about 2 hours after the snake bite. In an interview with NPR in September, Coutts said he'd been bitten 9 times in 22 years, and each time he recovered, he believed, through the power of his faith.
I enjoyed the feeling that moved on me to take up the serpent. Handling the snake, you know, it's indescribable. I mean, it's just, you have a peace. To know that you're holding something in your hand that could kill you, and yet you have no fear of it.
Death from religious snake handling is not unheard of. In 1995, a woman was bit in Coutts' church and died. Though handling serpents is a misdemeanor offense in most states where it's practiced, authorities rarely enforce it out of respect for religious liberty. There are an estimated 125 snake handling congregations scattered across Alabama, Georgia, the Carolinas, and Appalachia, where the tradition is strongest. Coutts continued to take up serpents even though he was arrested in 2008 by Kentucky wildlife authorities for trafficking in illegal snakes. He later obtained permits for the reptiles. He kept about 30 rattlers and copperheads in glass cages in a shed behind his house in Middlesboro. Coutts was known throughout the normally publicity-shy snake handling community as someone who wanted to educate the outside world about their practices and who was fearless in his faith.
I just like handling really, really big snakes.
And he said in this interview last year that he had his favorites.
Well, the black timber rattler, I just love some of the black timber rattlers. Their head just look like velvety. I mean, just it's such a shiny black.
His son, Cody Coutts, who's also a snake handler in church, told a local newspaper that the snake that gave his father the fatal bite was a 2.5-foot-long timber rattler. John Burnett, NPR News.
Let's turn to Faith Matters now. That's the part of the program where we talk about matters of religion, faith, and spirituality. It's Black History Month, so that got us thinking about the importance of faith to African Americans throughout history and to this day. But a recent piece in the Huffington Post religion section also got us thinking about how that faith practice is much more diverse than many people might realize. The editor solicited comments from people who practice everything from Orthodox Judaism to paganism to Buddhism to the Baha'i faith. Of course, we wanted to know more. So we called a couple of the people featured in the piece and asked them to describe their spiritual journeys. We got in touch with Timothy Conley, who's a member of the Baha'i faith, Buddhist meditation leader Gina Sharp, Jewish rapper Yitz Jordan. But first we hear from Debbie Goddard, who calls herself a humanist.
When my family moved to the suburbs when I was a teenager, I stopped hanging out with black people. My suburb was primarily white. So I looked forward to going to Temple University in Philadelphia. It's a very, very diverse campus. I made black friends again. Then I tried to start an atheist club, basically. And I asked some of my black friends if they'd be involved. And that's when I got the most pushback, when my friends who were involved in African American studies told me that atheism and humanism were harmful Eurocentric ideologies. And I had no response at the time. Everything that I'd learned about humanism and atheism, all the faces that I'd seen in the magazines and the books I was reading, were white men. And that really shook me. I thought, Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I've been snookered. And in some conversations with a couple of my close friends, you know, they basically said that if I accepted humanism, then I was turning my back on my race. And that was very upsetting to me. I actually am quite upset.
My name is Timothy Conley. What attracted me right away about the Baha'i Faith was the thought process of unity in some of the major Baha'i principles. And that was very different from what I grew up with. It was the first faith tradition I had discovered that felt that all the different major religions of the world are connected through divine teachers who come to this world, such as Muhammad or Jesus or Buddha or the Baha'i tradition, Baha'u'llah, et cetera, et cetera. So that those were very attractive things to me. And I was looking for a faith tradition where I could really study and learn. And I felt that the Baha'i tradition was opening that bridge for me. I jokingly say I still know how to speak fundamental and evangelical. I mean, it's the world I came from. I was at one point when I was 19 years old studying to be a minister while briefly attending the University of Oklahoma. I was in the Bible Belt, so it was easy for me to be surrounded in that energy. But for the family members that I've discussed it with, they've pretty much only asked me questions. They call it my Baha'i thing, you know, whatever that means.
Hi, my name is Gina Sharp. I teach Buddhist meditation. I encountered the teachings of the Buddha decades ago and essentially fell in love with the possibility of transcendent transformation that they offered. When I say transcendent transformation, what I mean is to be able to see into the causes of suffering in my own life. And so the teachings of the Buddha essentially bring us back to being so attentive and so connected to the way we're moving in the world that we have the possibility of shifting and transforming our relationship to what is happening in such a way that we're not causing our own suffering or the suffering of others.
Yitz Jordan.
It's on when the scripture clicks beyond what the chiddush is. Mitzvahs be the business. New school religious kicking vision in the ticking.
I grew up listening to hard rock and heavy metal music predominantly. Hip hop for me was something that was on the radio. And also being gay, that kind of exacerbated that because the hip-hop community in the 90s was the most homophobic place. You were persona non grata in the hip-hop show if you were out and gay at the time. So hip-hop for me wasn't even something I really considered until conversion. And then on my first year in yeshiva, the guy that they gave me to learn with was a rapper from Long Island, and he and I began to freestyle as a way to learn Talmud better.
When I say revolution, you say excuses? Why love the new scene? The old scheme is useless. Divine sun infused these no season.
My mother passed away in 2004, and when I was growing up, my mom would say a lot of the things that I would hear in the hood. You know, you'll never be accepted by the Jewish community. They'll never consider you one of them. And to a certain extent, she was right. Like, I had to deal with a lot of racism in the Jewish world when I first became Orthodox. It took me a long time to find an apartment. It took me a long time to find a job. There was a lot of discrimination. But ultimately, how much did the Jewish community accept me? In 2004, it would be donations from the Jewish community, which would pay for her funeral. So not only did they accept me, they accepted her too.
Believe in the people manifesting the skills with knowledge, understanding, wisdom, and will.
Before anyone who was a black Jew was considered as having bridged two communities, that these were two mutually exclusive identities and that there were people who were bringing them together. Now, you know, with that Black and Jewish video that made its rounds on YouTube, everybody's seen Drake's Bar Mitzvah, now you can get kosher chicken in Crown Heights. Black Jews have become just as much of a subsection of the Jewish community, just like Ashkenazi or Sephardi Jews or Israeli Jews or anything like that. And our culture's starting to be celebrated.
At the Vatican today, Pope Francis bestowed the traditional red hats on his first batch of cardinals. 10 of the 19 new princes of the Church come from outside Europe, from some of the poorest countries in the world. The new cardinals will eventually be responsible for electing a new pope. And Pier Silvia Poggioli reports the selection is seen as a sign that the reforms Pope Francis is introducing include a restructuring of how the Catholic Church will be governed.
The first pope from the developing world chose many of his new cardinals from the periphery of the globe. For example, from the Philippines, Burkina Faso, the Ivory Coast, and Haiti, places that had never had a cardinal before. John Allen, Vatican analyst for the Boston Globe, says the choices show the pope's desire to reduce the number of European cardinals and cardinals from the Curia, the central Vatican administration. It could be the start of a shift in the College of Cardinals to the global south, where two-thirds of the world's 1.2 billion Catholics today live.
Francis is making some choices, and one of those choices, clearly, is that he wants to shift the action in the Church away from the traditional centers of power to places that he thinks for too long have been ignored and overlooked.
Only four members of the Vatican administration were tapped to become cardinals. One of those is Gerhard Müller, head of the Vatican's doctrinal office and a known conservative. That's a sign, says Marco Politi, Vatican correspondent for the Italian daily Il Fatto, that Francis does not want only prelates who are on his same wavelength.
The Pope wants also that the College of the Cardinals represents the different trends within the Roman Church as they are.
When Francis announced his selections last month, perhaps the biggest surprise was the unprecedented letter he sent to each newly designated cardinal. He told them that the red hat should not be seen as a promotion, much less an honor. He asked them to accept the nomination with joy, but in a way that avoids any sign of worldliness, because cardinals, he said, should see themselves as servants marked by humility. This is in stark contrast, says John Allen, to the past, when wealthy donors or friendly religious orders threw lavish celebrations on the cardinal's behalf.
In Rome, Consistory Week is sort of like Oscars Week in Hollywood, you know? I mean, everybody's got a party, and often these things are fairly swanky black tie affairs.
Allen says Francis is trying to redefine leadership in the Catholic Church away from an image of power and privilege.
It's going to have to change in the direction of greater humility, simplicity, modesty.
In the lead-up to today's ceremony, Francis met with the entire College of Cardinals to discuss badly needed reform of the scandal-plagued Vatican Bank and preparations for an important worldwide bishops' assembly in October on the family. The discussion likely included the results of a worldwide survey that revealed many Catholics in the U.S. and Europe rejected as unrealistic church teaching on birth control, homosexuality, marriage, and divorce. Vatican analyst Marco Politi says Francis is inspired by the collegiality of the Second Vatican Council in the 1960s and wants cardinals and bishops to play a more decisive role in church governance.
He doesn't want to make the changes by himself, like a monarch. He wants to recreate an atmosphere like in Vatican Council II, where the bishops discuss and then together, in a common way, they take their decision.
Robert Mickens, Vatican correspondent for the British Catholic weekly The Tablet, says Francis has begun not only reforming the Vatican, but also the papacy itself.
In its style, in its tone, the whole ethos surrounding the old Vatican court, which he has basically just dismantled. He's sharing his power in a way. He's begun to set down the foundation stones for a new model of governance, or rather, a recovery of an ancient model of governance.
If he's able to carry it out, Mickens says, it will be the biggest change in the Catholic Church in 1,000 years. Sylvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
You know, even Nigella Lawson has had recipes for crockpot cooking. They're a convenience for many families. You throw in some kind of protein, beans, spices, hours later, dinner. This kind of meal is part of a long and cherished tradition among many Jewish families, known in Yiddish as chulent. The meal is cooked for a full day before being served on the Sabbath, when for Orthodox Jews, lighting a fire or cooking is prohibited. Reporter Dina Pritchett reports on a dish full of beans and affection.
For Devorah Wilhelm, and for observant Jews across the world, Friday afternoon usually sounds like this.
Now I fry a bunch of onions, and we're going to peel potatoes.
Wilhelm, like many religious Jews, doesn't do any sort of work on the Sabbath, from Friday night to Saturday night, including turning on the stove. So how do you have a hot lunch on Saturday? You make a long-cooked stew, starting a full day ahead. It's called cholent.
I'm going to throw in pinto beans and barley. And I'm going to put in potatoes, some chicken.
Over a day of slow cooking, flavors infuse, beans soften, and tough cuts of meat become tender. The version Wilhelm is making goes back to a family friend from Eastern Europe. But cholent itself, in one form or another, goes back much further.
The dish comes out of the Middle East, and then it spreads to North Africa, and then by the 9th century, it's already found in Spain.
Food historian Gil Marks has traced different versions of cholent, from these starting places on through Eastern Europe and into America. The names vary from cholent to adafina to hamim, and so do the seasonings.
If you go to Morocco, you'll find cumin, maybe coriander or cinnamon mixed in. Once you get to Hungary, you'll find paprika.
And Marx maintains that cholent didn't just change shape in different countries. It gave rise to new dishes. From French cassoulet.
We do find a number of French sources from the Catholic Church forbidding Christians from eating long-cooked bean dishes because it's Jewish.
To Boston-baked beans, which the Puritans picked up during their time in Holland.
They took a dish of beans cooked in goose fat with honey, and they don't have goose, so they substitute pork, and they don't have honey, so they substitute either maple syrup or molasses.
Unfortunately, these cholent theories on Boston-baked beans and cassoulet can be difficult to really prove. But cholent has changed modern American cooking in ways that are undeniable.
My dad's name was Irving Naxon, and he was an inventor. He had over 200 patents.
Lenore Naxon's father came up with patents for everything from washing machines to sending data over telephone wires. But one of his most popular ideas was inspired by his mother's stories of making cholent in Lithuania.
She would walk it over to the village bakery, where as the ovens were turned off for the Sabbath, the pot of cholent would be put in the oven, and that slow residual heat over the course of the 24 hours would be enough to cook the cholent.
After services, the kids would pick up their pots for a warm Sabbath meal.
So my father heard this story and thought, well, how can I take the crock and electrify it with some slow, even heat?
His invention was called the Naxon Beanery, later renamed the Crockpot. It's an idea that went from the Middle East to a little shtetl in Lithuania to millions of American homes. And in some of them, it's still being used to make cholent. For NPR News, I'm Dina Pritchett.
And you can mark my words that this will happen real soon. Cholent-powered rockets will take men to the